69th best show of the 21st century, according to the dreaded swamp people of the island of Britain.
This is our first episode recording since the coronation also.
Yeah. So I wonder if, the new king is going to get into the TV lists and start messing with them. I bet he likes 24 more than his mom did.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, there's the whole thing. First, should introduce ourselves.
No. I'm Ian. Here, as always, with my co-host.
Ryan Swen. And I was thinking about, first of all, you mentioning that just makes me think of Obama's like best of the year lists.
Yes.
And the concept of what that would be like for King Charles. But also, like, I'm also thinking about the fact that Charles has like a much greater like at least awareness or something like that of Islam and the people of the Middle East, as far as I know.
Yeah.
So like, that's something I wasn't really aware of before, like the past few months or so. But it's something that's fascinates me, especially the photo of him, is all in traditional garb. I wonder how he would respond to that in 24.
Yeah, what would a British 24 look like?
That's a good question. I mean, like, yeah, that's the thing. Even though, like, I don't think it's been one of the constant comparisons, but certainly the specter of James Bond has been invoked in relation to 24. Not necessarily with the most accuracy, but it's still like something there. But
yeah, I think you could make an argument that like the Craig era, yeah, at least early on, is a little bit influenced by mm-hmm. by 24.
Mm-hmm. Before it became more directly like just about him as a person, I guess.
Yeah, but well, you know how I feel about No Time to Die. but I wonder if, like, because British TV is structured so differently, I just wonder if there are like shows that have tried, like in the wake of 24, to try and like do a British version. Because like James Bond is a little bit like, I mean, I think 24 is kind of like somewhat a little bit influenced by James Bond, and then the kind of feel of some moments in the Craig era. Mm-hmm. Are definitely, you know, post 24, yeah. but I wonder if there's like a TV show that tried to do that, you know.
Well, it is funny that the season that takes place in London is the one where they switch to 12 episodes. Obviously, that's still longer than
it's a great homage to the British TV tradition.
Yeah, I wonder about like if they try to study anything related to like a miniseries format specifically for related to British TV or not.
They
should have called it like a series. They should have just called it its own series.
Yeah,
like how they call their season series.
But wasn't it kind of like, doesn't it have like some Bondish sort of title?
Well, yeah, Live Another Day.
Yeah. That's like, yeah. Come on. I do wonder. I mean, I have zero knowledge really of like non-English language TV, so sure. I wonder how like the Japanese and Indian. Mm-hmm. 24s like compare and contrast to like what the, you know, what other kinds of shows are on TV there, because I get the impression, I haven't watched them, but I get the impression from reading about them that they're pretty directly lifting like a lot of the beats and the formula.
Yeah, as far as I know, like isn't it still 24 episodes also?
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah,
I'd have to check the recent Japanese series, because that's been the Indian one, I don't think is ongoing, right?
No, I think it was, what, two seasons as far as I know?
Yeah.
Which is honestly pretty good. Kind of surprised that they got that far, especially if they did the exact similar beats. I do also want to shout out, because you mentioned that, like I very much like that you followed the 24 Japan on on Twitter.
I just want to support what they're doing.
It's a great list of various people that you followed. You followed Homeland Security, you followed Fox.
Well, I had to get us to like 24 following, so
yeah, we have two more follow us please. and we can follow you back.
Yeah, I don't know what happened, because I had it at 24. I wonder if some accounts have left in the,
yeah, I think so,
under the new regime.
Yeah.
I haven't gone back in there to fix it, but
yeah, I'm sure surely there's at least one or two other people who acted on 24 that we can follow.
Yeah, I wonder who I definitely feel like it must be like a cast, like a lib cast member who left Twitter in a huff. I wonder who it
was. It's certainly possible.
Yeah.
But yes, we are covering the hours from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m.
Kind of the siesta time, you know?
Yeah, it's sort of, it did amuse me greatly to see Palmer just snacking on like a small sandwich and some grapes and cheese.
And like the weird spread of greens that he had. I don't know. Maybe that was like a garnish. It seemed like a lot of greens for a garnish, but it was not arranged like a salad.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't. Yeah, it was like sort of, I strongly suspect that was just something that they carried over from craft services.
That's so true. They probably had some shit like laid out on a bed of lettuce or something, just like for the look of it. And they were like, we need some food for this. I wonder if that was like a director choice or an actor choice.
Yeah, I hope that Haysbert just he said he wanted to like. It might as well eat, even though it's already almost 4 p.m. Just might as well eat. So he decided to bring it in, and then the Whitmore just decided to let him go at it.
Yeah,
it's good. Like it was funny seeing it first in the split screen when they're coming back from commercial, and then in his scene.
Yeah, for a show that takes place over a whole day, like we basically never see anyone eating, which I think is a huge missed opportunity. I would love to just like. Have Mason charging around right now, just like gnawing on a burger or something that someone brought him. I feel like I could
see him being like just carrying around a stick of beef jerky just at all times.
That's so true.
He's like wielding it like a cigar or something like that.
Yeah, Tony seems like a mixed nuts guy.
Yeah,
a little can of mixed nuts.
Well, yeah, but that we had Milo, remember, with the cashews.
Yes.
Maybe that's why people don't carry around. It's too much of a security liability.
Yeah, maybe they changed. Maybe they like they had to update the employee manual. That's like you really cannot have food or drink at your desk. But yeah, so that's what happened. So no one has food at their desk. But
yeah,
then
Mason is swinging from
blown
them.
Up, and the fridge was a casualty. So
Mason was swinging on like a bottle of water. Throughout these episodes, I think.
Yeah, I like that it's a. I mean that could be like the like emergency services maybe brought some bottles of water, but I also like to think that like CTU is not like a water cooler office, but just like has stacks of like a pallet of water bottles just like in the break area, and they're room temperature, of course, and you have to drink them in like the designated zone so that you don't spill them on anything important.
Yeah. Yeah, these are. I think that, especially I don't know why episode 7 specifically, but I think that like these are, I think certainly episode 7 I think is really quite strong. I think it's keeping in like the same sort of like run of quality that I think it gets maybe curtailed a little bit in episode 8, but still like it's I was really kind of impressed. Yeah, it's just generally speaking like the. Especially just with the staging of that, I was surprised. I feel like that raid is like a lot more high octane. It had a lot higher budget than like past 24 raids.
Yeah, I mean we had the warehouse raid at the beginning of this season where Mason gets infected, but that was pretty quick. Although that one was still like pretty exciting.
I think it's more like the FBI just like having them like entire battering ram people and like
the bolt cutters.
Oh yeah, that too.
Yeah, I think that
the guy rappelling from the roof.
just
spraying
like
around.
Like, I don't know, what is it like? Some kind of air shaft or something? I love driving the van into the window or the SUV. That's such a great move. It's like, what are you doing there? Like they don't really drive through.
It's like to block off the place, but it's also like needlessly excessive.
It's so excessive. Yeah, I mean, it definitely we're starting to get into a lot of scary Muslim tropes.
Oh, definitely. Well, like, especially because everyone in the place has an assault rifle or SMG of some kind.
Yeah, I mean the lady, the shot with the lady is pretty gratuitous as far as she just like. She goes crazy and they just like waste her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think though that both these episodes are kind of locked into a rhythm that feels like, you know, 24 Classico mode.
Oh, definitely.
It's like, I mean, each episode is not 60 minutes, but it covers 60 minutes, but it's like 58 minutes of like intrigue and then a crazy, you know, like next week on 24 kind of cliffhanger ending that, that like suddenly escalates, you know, the tension. But the Palmer intrigue stuff is, I think, really working because that's like the best. I think that's right now they've got like the best ensemble of actors working together. So. Like, there's no weak link there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's still the Mason stuff is maybe like the strongest, just like as its like own sort of emotional sort of thing.
For sure.
But, but just the delight of seeing like Michelle Forbes and Penny Johnson-Trill just going at it.
So good.
And having Mike back also is like just him just striding in, and he's like very cordial with Sherry, which is kind of a nice move. It's really fun to see like just having him as like this sort of like glue sort of presence.
Yeah.
I think a really crucial thing to making this whole weird like five-way dynamic really work.
Yeah, well, it works too because like everybody except Palmer, you know, everybody's kind of orbiting around Palmer, but everybody else has a foil, right? So, you know, like I think Mike and Roger only get like one scene together, but you can tell that like these are old hands. Like they're playing like four-dimensional chess with each other, you know. That's very fun. I like the idea that Mike is just like, hey, I'm going to annoy you all day. And you can't do anything about it because I'm the chief of staff.
Yeah. He's just like him just offering to work with him, even though he knows that there's absolutely no way he's going to be like a nice presence. It's very fun.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn and Sherry just has these sort of, a lot of it is certainly just, I don't think that, I actually don't know how much Lynn knows about like the stuff that Sherry did really behind the scenes, or how much really anyone besides like Mike and maybe a few other people knows. So like I could definitely see her reputation just being as like the ex-wife rather than like this real power player in the national landscape.
I definitely think she has an inkling that,
sure,
you know, something is, what I like about the dynamic is, first of all, you know, this is like Star Trek School of Acting.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
These are Hall of Fame alums here, right? Like, I mean, when the school opens, like their scenes in this episode will be like week one material of how to act on television. But I like too that it's not just it's not a totally antagonistic relationship. Like they have they have motives that have some like parallels but also some like intersections, and it's sort of like they're both trying to maneuver themselves in a certain way that may end up in like a straight-on antagonistic relationship, but it's handled very, very well because Lynn kind of ends up showing off a little bit as like, hey, I know how to do this. Like I know what I'm doing here. Like you think you know more than I know, but that's not always true. I love that bit. But then of course, like Penny Johnson-Gerald has this great thing where she's just like exudes this like evil charisma.
Yeah.
That's just so good. It's so good. And you're like, I don't know if Lynn can take the heat.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. There's like this sort of like unstoppable force, immovable object sort of dynamic.
Yeah.
That like, it's just seeing the, yeah, it's like because Lynn is perfectly like sort of competent.
The model,
like, of course. Yeah, and of course she talks about that sort of sense of competence in when they're just trying to work through this initial sort of encounter, and especially just like I like how their first conflict is about this perhaps greater knowledge, perhaps withholding of information. With regards to Stanton's meeting with the minority leader, I think it really just like captures that sort of precise ambiguity of not knowing exactly how much Lynn has access to, but also not knowing how much Sherry is willing to say or to withhold to, in order to serve her interests.
Yeah, I love that, you know, just like this Machiavellian like mastermind, but versus the totally competent like technocrat who she is like the sort of exception that proves the rule of meritocracy, where it's like there's a lot of people around her that are just, you know, striving careerists that are aspiring, you know, Sherry Palmers, but don't have the juice. and like she is like the one person who like, because she's been up against that all the time, like she's honed this kind of skill set that directly like matches with Sherry's. It's just very good stuff. And I love to, I think it's in episode 8. I love to when Sherry is talking to David and they're, you know, talks about, you know, how she's kind of tried to change and, you know, it's such a like a complicated sort of position she's trying to take up, but then she's like she's talking about power and she's like, but of course, you know, I love it. And it's like yeah, and you can see like I think that season one it was a little hard to see by the end, like why were these two people together at all. That was maybe like a question that I had after season one, but now you kind of get it now, because like Sherry is right, like he's not there without her, but she couldn't get to the position that she had without him either, you know. And like they're kind of like it's a toxic relationship because of that, but that's also why they were so professionally successful.
Right, and of course like it gets a much better backing when the kids aren't around, basically. When it's just purely about power, like when it has, like in some ways, it kind of makes it fitting that the kids don't show up at all for the rest of the series. but she continues to have this resonance. Like it fits with the sort of move towards the Palmer as this like, figure of power, like this one, like negotiating his way through it. It gets a lot better. I also do want to note that on the I'm currently on Wiki 24, and an ad appeared for some kind of bottled water on Amazon. So
they're listening.
They're listening, definitely.
They know.
As far as I know, I haven't looked at a for Propel bottled water, so that's or whatever it's like, you know, like Zero Electric Light or whatever.
Thing.
So
yeah,
it's a very, 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 very prominent sort of awareness thing to whoever is listening in currently.
They know what we like.
Yeah.
I'm loving the Palmer stuff, and it's also the only stuff that doesn't really pull out like a wild revelation or explosive, like I mean the journalist guy whose name I haven't bothered to learn, the journalist guy getting out and like knowing that Sherry kind of like played that a certain way is kind of serves that, but it's so subdued compared to like other stuff going on.
Well, or like, also like, to the like when the ambassador got blown up.
That's a little more sensational, but even then it's like we watch it on television and we only have like one scene with those characters, so we know that it like like if the show was just about the Palmer intrigue, these would be like big episode ending kind of things, but because it's like propped up against the ridiculous stuff that happens in like the Jack and Kim plots, it feels much more natural to what's going on there. And this isn't to say that I hate the ridiculous stuff that's going on. I love the ridiculous stuff that's going on. But I'm glad that they didn't go for, like, you know, a triple stinger in one of these.
Yeah.
Because that would be, like, a little too much.
Well, I like how there's, like, double stinger, essentially with first Nina slitting the guy's throat and then the plane getting shot down.
That's such a great 24. That's 24 in a microcosm right there. It's just like, oh, you think that this is the big thing that's going to happen this episode, but it's actually a red herring to make you forget that something else even worse can just randomly all of a sudden happen.
Just to be clear, we're actually recording. I haven't actually edited episode 3 yet, but we'll be recording this one and the next one over the back-to-back, or essentially today and tomorrow, before I leave for Taiwan. I don't know if we'll actually record episodes when we're in Taiwan. It's definitely a possibility, but just wanted to say, and I am excited that like these particular episodes are, or this set of four episodes are all together.
Yeah.
There's definitely some very, very fun insanity coming up.
Yeah, I'm very excited for these next two, which I even though we're recording tomorrow, I have not watched them yet.
Exactly what I was hoping, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My worry was that I'm not very good at this, and I would have started talking about the wrong episodes. And then it was like they would have been too mixed up, and so I just stuck with these two.
Yeah. Before we move off of the Palmer stuff, like there were two things. Like I love the line that Sherry says to Mike, is like we learn from our mistakes and we grow from our misfortunes. Yeah. And then he asks if she's told Palmer that.
That was so good.
Yeah, and then there's a weird moment when Mike is talking with Palmer in his office, and then like there's twice that they look over at Stanton, and it like literally looks like he's teleported. That was a fun bit of like weird continuity that like where like one moment he's talking, standing up talking to some people, and then like 15 seconds later he's already sat down at that sort of sunken down war room table, that I thought was pretty fun.
Yeah, that's how you know you're dealing with a pro TV director, because they don't care about continuity. Like, what are you doing? This is why I'm saying, like, it's such a shame that Jonathan Frakes never directed an episode of 24. Two take Frakes, like that's what we need. that's the spirit of television right there, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I actually don't know who directs the, because we actually, is it all is all Hopkins in Legacy, or he does at least a bunch of them, right?
He does a lot of them. I don't know if he does all of them. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at it in a minute.
Yeah, he does three episodes.
Okay. Yeah,
a fourth of the season. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they could have gone Frakes for that stretch, or at least one of them. But yeah, on to the which do you want to pick?
Let's just talk about Kim. Let's just do it.
I want to hear what you think of this. I think it's very funny that there's almost none of her in episode 7. Like there's actually one moment when you get like a split screen of her coming back from commercial while they're driving, but then it doesn't really come back until pretty close to the end of the episode.
Yeah, this feels like actually a rare moment in the show where driving takes any time at all.
Yeah, I mean, like San Jose is one place that they can't like quite skip over. I was actually sort of thinking about that in terms of the flying that they're doing, in terms of the plane, just because like they obviously there's a little bit more room for them to move around and like do dramatic things on the plane, but still like it does actually take like a good amount of time to fly to Visalia. But
yeah,
for driving like San Jose, like they say 4 or 5 hours, that is definitely right in terms of your driving up from LA.
Yeah, I also appreciate that, like I feel like there was definitely a, like, you know, the writer's room was all together and they were like getting things set, you know, for this next episode, and they were like, what on earth are we gonna do with Kim? Like, and they were like, let's just stuff her in a car, they're on a road trip, like we can just forget about her for like an episode until the end. I literally don't remember anything about what goes on with the Kim stuff until the end of that episode, because it's so inconsequential until they get pulled over for speeding, which, you know, again, it's just like, I don't know. You're like, I get that you're trying to get out of the city, but you're also in a stolen vehicle. Like, don't you want to not call attention to yourself?
I've forgotten that.
This one's not on Kim, though. This one's not Kim's fault.
Yeah, there's like this episode, Miguel has definitely assumed more of a Rick role in terms of like, you know, going around speeding, going around running his mouth about the nuke.
Well, you know, they've done actually kind of a smart thing, which is that they've taken dumb Kim,
yeah,
and made it her boyfriend,
yeah,
which is like kind of genius a little bit because Kim is like way less annoying in comparison. Absolutely. Kim seems actually to be like, you know, kind of pretty level headed. Like, it sort of immediately is like, look, my dad works for this important government organization. Mm-hmm. This is a misunderstanding. Like, mm-hmm. you need to let us go. Blah blah blah. Mm-hmm.
This guy actually seems to know what CTU is, or does she say like it's a government agency also?
I think that it's not as much a deal. Like, we don't get the direct "what the heck is that" that we often get. But I think that it's not until like we don't see him checking into it, but he says, you know, I checked in to you, and your dad does actually work for this. So I get the sense that maybe before he wasn't really taking her seriously, so that mm-hmm. wasn't like the important part. Like, maybe he knew or didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. I feel like after the events of season one, like if you're a cop in the you know in the environs surrounding Los Angeles, you probably have a little bit of knowledge. Like, you've heard CTU before, probably. But I definitely don't think it's like until after he like checks into her that he's like, oh, this is what this is, mm-hmm. and who you mm-hmm. are and what's going on.
Right. But it didn't seem like they were going that fast, but also knowing that Highway Patrol has a certain quota that they have to reach.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably like the end of the month, you know?
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I did read, I don't know if it's the trivia for this episode or the next one, but I did read someone say that one of the phone displays at some point says that it's September 25th, 2002.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, I actually don't remember when we sort of settled on when it happened. Yeah. I don't think that's obviously not to
well, we're in 24 time. But my argument, and this is a divisive position in the 24 community apparently, because a lot of people for whatever reason think that season one takes place in 2002, which is just goofball shit to me, because I don't think there's any reason to think that elections happen in different years in the 24 mm-hmm. universe. Mm-hmm. So it's either 2000 or 2004. And 2000 mm-hmm. makes the most sense given the focus
Palmer stopping
on
9/11.
Palmer 9/11 does not happen. Palmer stops 9/11. Like, season one is about Eastern European terrorists. Mm-hmm. Season two, though, is about Middle Eastern terrorists. So like, stopping 9/11 has happened between mm-hmm. the two seasons. So mm-hmm. like, yeah, I mean, September 2002 makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, obviously the show sort of takes place outside of those kind of considerations.
Yeah.
But
I would put it maybe more towards like a summer, or like maybe late summer, but
September
is perfectly decent also.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, you know, you live there, so, but I know here, at least in the wastelands, like, you know, it can be, it could be 65 degrees on September 25th, or it could be 90 degrees on September 25th. You know, it does seem like summer-ish.
Yeah, yeah, summer-ish, but like it's not that hot. Like,
yeah.
People, you know, you had Jack in his flannel.
Yeah.
And like Nina changing into her coat and combo. Like, it's not the same as what she was wearing before.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah, maybe late summer, early fall, where the weather's kind of variable, you know,
it would have been
weather.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have been a great bit if Jack had given her the exact same clothes.
Oh, that would have been so good. That's a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
We are somewhat dancing around what actually happens in the Kim plot, which is that there's a body in the trunk and it belongs to the little girl's mother.
I don't know how I feel about that sort of twist.
I was fine with it.
The sort of thing where like, it's like it's tasteless to a certain degree, but like it's tasteless in like a more palatable sort of way.
I mean, this guy is a monster.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, absolutely.
I think they're really just like taking that ball all the way down the field, which is probably necessary to like, because I think that up until this point, it's been somewhat ambiguous about what he would actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like very unambiguous. Although I will say, as those who follow me on Twitter may have noticed, I've been watching New Perry Mason. and I will say that the gore quotient in 24 is severely lacking after watching the just like consummate craftsmanship of the absolutely hideous corpses on display in New Perry Mason.
So, I actually didn't know that New Perry Mason had corpses like that.
It is, you know, I mean, look, this is not everybody's thing, but when I see this stuff, I just like appreciate the craftsmanship that goes into making something so disgusting. Like, so it doesn't turn my stomach in the way that it might reasonably for other people.
Yeah. It doesn't turn my stomach for sure. Like, it's like this, but, like in terms of like the narrative sort of turn.
Yes. Like, yeah. Yeah. definitely. New Perry Mason has some of the best crafted gore I've ever seen, certainly on television, but rivaling even some movies for me, but of course, like, you know, 24 network television, I think it's enough that the mom is in the trunk and the little girl is in the car. Like, that's pretty, that's pretty wild. And like the blood dripping down is like, how is that even getting out of there?
Yeah. It's like, it's weird. Like, it almost like it's dripping out of the tailpipe or something like that. But there's clearly no way for that to happen. Also, you mentioning New Perry Mason has me fantasizing about like a plot point or like a like sort of through line in whatever season three, like when like, because they season two is done now, right? Or like it's aired, so like,
yes,
presumably they're going to season three unless it's been canceled. Like, it has me fantasizing about them introducing Mason's father, George Mason.
That would be so great.
Yeah, when he's time traveled out of his fate in this season and into 1940s New York or something, or LA or whatever it is.
I know I'm only on season one and it's like 1932, I think.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not sure how much season two jumps, but you know, it exists in the greater Los Angeles extended universe. So
sure,
these shows, in my mind, are take place in the same timeline. There's no reason why they couldn't. I'm like way out on a limb here, but I do wonder if like, if they do bring 24 back, which of course Kiefer Sutherland gets asked about like all the time.
Yeah.
I do wonder if some kind of like limited, you know, of streaming or, streaming and or cable sort of series is going to, you know, turn up the sex and violence, or if they're going to try to go for that big network swing again. I wonder, because it kind of feels like if it would have come back like 2-3 years ago, that wouldn't have even been a question. It would have been like a streaming show. But now I'm like wondering if, you know, if it does come back, if they might try to do some kind of, you know, some kind of reinvigoration of that sort of model on network television. Cause I don't think there's really a show quite like that on network TV right now. And I don't think there has been for a while.
Yeah. I mean, like I've always been bad with tracking exactly which are network, which are like at least currently, like what shows are. Yeah. For, I mean, like for 24 Legacy, that was still on Fox, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
So like, that's a good question. Yeah. I really am not sure. But back to Carla.
Like, I mean,
on the one hand, I think the problem maybe I have with it is just like that it encourages once again the Kim in custody once again, that sort of like beating her head against the wall sort of dynamic.
They've got one move, you know.
Yeah, basically.
It's the pick and roll of 24. I do think that it's kind of tasteless in a way that I appreciate.
Sure. Yeah.
Again, that kind of like soapy element of the show coming out. And because it's happening, like, I mean, you know, this is what 24 does, right? You got this plot line going in the episode that seems totally inconsequential, but then that's of course where the big end of episode scene comes in. But it is annoying that Kim is once again back in custody. That just, I wonder what, like, if we, like, planned it out, like, how many episodes of the show we had so far and how many of them has Kim spent in some kind of custody? It's, like, almost the whole show up to that.
Yeah, that too. I mean, like, technically, like, the hospital and things like that also count to a certain degree just because of the, just because of that sort of institutional nature where like she feels entrapped and things like that.
Just like the stasis, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like and so like that sense of stasis is just like so preeminent. And these sort of twists sort of encourage that. Like it's just like this sort of it's just like sort of an interesting the way that the
I think it comes down again to them just like not quite knowing what Kim can do outside of being a person that Jack cares about mm-hmm. and like can't help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she just they can't bring her into her own as a character in the way that they're able to. And I don't think that's like on Lesha Cuthbert's performance.
No.
I think she's being given very little to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this season, she's doing more with that than she did in the last season.
Yeah.
And that could come down to like direction and stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Better understanding the character as well.
Yeah, exactly. But it just feels like they can't, like they're just kind of playing the hits here mm-hmm. because they don't know what to do with her. You know, it mm-hmm. almost feels like they had an obvious solution, which could have been to somehow like loop Kim into like the wedding plot, right? Like what if it was like a friend of Kim's, you know?
Oh, that's a great point.
And then
actually,
you have this like tight triangle and it's like so she is kind of embroiled in this stuff by proxy, by accident. Mm-hmm. And so we always have a familiar character in those scenes in uh-huh. the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
But I sort of see why they didn't do that, because maybe they were worried that it feels like, well, isn't it coincidental enough that like Jack keeps getting roped into all this? Maybe it's a little much to have his daughter mm-hmm. roped so directly into it mm-hmm. yet again. But I think that the show would have been able to get over that very quickly, because yeah. now it's kind of like, I get why we're following Kim, but I kind of don't get it. It feels so much more outside of what else is going on in the show right now.
that's the mind of a writer working right there. That's actually kind of a brilliant idea. I completely had not thought of that solution, but man, that would have been really fun.
Yeah, and I just think it would have given us a chance, like, which we still don't have, to just mm-hmm. see Kim in a setting where it's normal.
Yeah.
Right? Like in the mm-hmm. in the first season, we get like maybe those first one or two episodes before things go sideways. Mm-hmm. And we get a little bit of a sense of who she is. And then mm-hmm. in this, it's like, I mean, the au pair stuff is right away a perilous situation, you know, that becomes mm-hmm. clear very quickly. So we don't mm-hmm. get like, we just don't get a sense of what her like day-to-day life is, which I mm-hmm. feel like we have even for characters like in CTU, because that's their job. Like mm-hmm. everybody else we see at their job, and we see Kim at her job too, but we see her at a job that isn't like, it doesn't seem like a dangerous job.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it immediately becomes like right. this violent situation that she has mm-hmm. to like get out of. But yeah, so that's my edit for 24 season 2 is make Kim a friend of the wedding family.
That would be... That is a great idea.
well, it's too late now, unfortunately. But,
unfortunately.
I just I don't want to complain too much about the Kim plot, because I did kind of like the twist for its like tastelessness and willingness
yeah,
to just like go buck wild. But
right,
it
right.
still feels like they're just like the
yeah. It's a great twist. It's the sort of thing where like it's sort of just deciding to bring it back in the most or bring back that sort of, like, because the last time you see her, she's like, she's being confronted at the house. Last time you see Carlos, like, just to go to that place after like four episodes like away from that, I think like it is kind of a like it's sort of it's like it elevates the tastelessness in a certain way, but like in a way that could work if they could find some way of making it as not just Kim in a police station again.
Yeah, well, and like we get like it, part of the reason it works is because this character is so inconsequential that we've forgotten about her.
Yeah,
right. Basically. So it's like all this, like, it's because it's just like not on our radar at that
mm-hmm,
point.
Mm-hmm,
It still does, even though like in the moment watching it, I was like, oh yeah, classic 24. Like really, like just really enjoyed this episode.
Yeah.
Maybe in a way that made me like sort of undervalue its merits a little bit, because it just kind of humming along nicely.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But at the same time, it still feels a little bit like, you know, they're they're resuscitating the patient on the table. You know, they know that this kid stuff is dying again, and they gotta just like zap it with something. Yeah. And I know that this season includes just like an escalating series of events like that, which is like, you know, they sort of painted themselves into a corner, and I get that it's like you have to keep it, you got to keep it going for 24 episodes somehow. So
yeah,
I don't totally begrudge the move they make to just make it more ridiculous, because it's fun and stupid. So
And also the I think it leads to one of the single greatest sequences in the show so far, which is that like five six way phone call in the like in episode
yes.
eight.
Yes. That's,
like yeah. where you have Jack, Kim, Michelle, Mason, like all passion to a phone call, while you also have Nina whispering to the guy over in the on the other side of the plane. And you have just like that sort of perfect sort of juggling of all those different people interacting, and you have the just like that sort of him trying to suss out and like constantly trying to tear himself away from talking to Kim in order so that I can get listen in on what Nina's trying to say, and like that's just like some really really skillful stuff, like with the split screens also. Like I was really impressed by that scene. Like it's like it's sort of like what 24 can do best is just having all these perspectives that it can juggle at the same time.
Yeah, and that's like one of the things that I think eventually will make the sensationalist stuff go from being like fun and exciting to like a little bit like, okay, haven't we been here before? Is that the show is actually at its best like when people are on the phone, which I think is like hard to make compelling. But I don't, they just like cracked the code here. The split screen obviously is a big part of that, because you can have everybody together, but like the way that that call sequence is like getting built, like people keep getting added to it and layers keep getting added, and it's like all of a sudden like all of our like main sort of like principles are all together, even though they're all spread across these different plot lines at that moment. It's really brilliant. That's like, I mean, I think that's one of the best sequences of the whole series so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, it's especially because it so directly links like the two things that Jack wants to do the most, like to protect Kim and to stop terrorism just at large.
that's the whole show right there. That's so good. Yeah. Just so a dad on a mission.
Basically. It's just like the escalation of that, and also like the very like I was wondering exactly, because I knew that Nina would pull that trick with the gift card, and also you can also, you know, make you can read into it very heavily and say like the perversity of having a Islamic terrorist having a slit throat by like a consumerist object. Can certainly make that, you can make that point, but like I was like, she did actually manage to make it into like a sharp enough weapon. I was kind of wondering how that would happen.
Yeah. That's like this is a rich show for, you know, symptomatic reading. I mean, I think this is why I eventually capitulated to like doing the podcast. Not that you had to convince me or anything, but it's because I'm lazy. It's not.
Yeah, sure.
But it's because I just feel like, it's a show that really will, like, if you want to understand the last 25 years, I think that this show is like a kind of skeleton key. And partially it's that, because it's not at all trying to be that.
No, like they're just frantically searching for solutions out of problems.
Yes.
And the things that they have around are just fertile objects for that.
It's like a self-reflective, like, or self-conscious, like, you know, better, like quote unquote better show, like is just gonna be too aware of what it's trying to do, and like I mean 24 is constantly just like a maze that they've built for themselves, and they're just like rats frantically scrambling to find the exit, you know, and they have to come up with all this stuff, but it's like because of that the instinctual stuff is actually like very revealing about like, yeah, what was 2002 like? You know? And it's right there at exactly what you said, which is, you know, a gift card shiv cutting through the throat of of a, like, you know, stereotypical, you know, terrorist figure.
Also, I've always been, like, I'm constantly surprised and, like, and impressed by how good it seems like Sarah Clark is at picking up or conveying dialogue in non-English, in like, in languages that are not English. Like, you had that moment when that were, like, those scenes when she was talking German, right? In the end of season one.
Yeah.
And she seems, like, I don't think they actually specified the dialects, which is maybe a another sort of their protective measures, but, like, she seems to be conveying it pretty well, at least to my ears.
Yeah, I mean, isn't there some kind of throwaway line at some point about not even being sure what dialect he speaks or something?
Oh yeah, they checked it out. So that's why they have that translator there. Typing away in the backgrounds, which is a nice touch. I like that sort of that relaying that Michelle is doing of what the translator is picking up and, like.
Yes, that's very good.
Yeah, that sort of triangle of information is very effective, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the only I think the Jack stuff is working really well.
Yeah.
You
have that moment when Nina complains that he'd be able to shoot her and then turn the gun on himself, and then Jack says, "Well, be sure to make that he can't turn the gun on himself."
Yes, that's such a good line.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a standing ovation line, right? There. I hope everybody knew how good of a job they did on that one. Like, it's the delivery is perfect, the setup is perfect. Like, it's just very, very well constructed.
Yeah. And I also like the FBI guys just turn their guns on Jack as he's just raging.
He just closes the door, I do wonder a little bit. I'm wondering about your read on this. I'm not sure what Jack thinks is going to happen there. Like, I don't know. I think that the only thing that it's not that it's not working, but that I'm not quite sure they figured out exactly, like, the balance between Jack wanting revenge, understandably, and also trying to do the job. Like, I think that scene was, like, teetering on the edge where I'm like, oh, what are we going to do here? You know?
Yeah. Like, I think the best moment of that is when Jack has her cornered and, like, and it holds on that scene for, like, 30 seconds before he says to handcuff her. And, like, there's no dialogue in that sequence, crucially. And so I think that when it's able to just rely on those images and your knowledge of everything in the background simmering there, like, it, I think it really works there. And also the monologue he gives. Which is just really great stuff. And, like, weirdly, and this partly because Strange Days has been on the brain because of our Zero Dark Thirty talk, but, like, the description he gives feels like, especially the rollerbladers, like, it reminded me a lot of that of one of the memories or one of the videos that Ray Fiennes is watching of his ex-wife in of her, like, rollerblading in somewhere, but, like, just like that him being able to just, like, talk about that, and Nina not necessarily having too much of a reaction, she still has that hinge of, or that, like, edge of smugness at having managed to outsmart him, or, like, to be able to make herself indispensable in a certain way. It's like, and to have that, the balance of that scene, especially for it to be able to slow down like that and just, like, stay entirely in that right before the plane gets blown up. It really works.
Yeah, because this is not, like, a monologue show, you know?
No,
And I think that, like, that could have gone very wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it just works perfectly. It's, like, not overdoing it. Mm-hmm. You get the sense that, like, Jack hasn't been rehearsing that necessarily, but that it always, whether he knew it or not, was sort of in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and of course, like, once, like, obviously his first reaction is just, like, blind rage at this, at this person, you know? But then it's, like, that's just, like, such a great kind of tender moment, which the show doesn't get very many of.
Right.
They're more effective, I think, because of that. Because, like, we just get him talking for you know, a minute or so.
Mm-hmm. I remember there was like a, there was like that phone call that he made, I think, to Terry.
Yeah.
When he's like hiding under the car in season one or something like that.
Yes.
So like, and like, Kiefer's got the monologues.
Yeah.
Like it's sparingly deployed. I like also that the Wiki 24 page just has like a big block quote. Yeah. Of this entire monologue.
Yes. Yeah. Nice, I saw that. Well. I saw that. That's so great. Yeah. I love, I think it's during like when they send Nina in and she's got mm-hmm. that like necklace with the camera yeah. on or whatever. I love the little like flip screen monitor yeah. Jack has. Yeah. I think this season the technology in 24 is actually much more realistic than it was last
yeah,
season.
I there think so.
Been very like magic, very many like magic no. moments.
Except for that guy that hacks into the well, I guess he has like a USB drive that
it's actually an does... MP3 player that he plugs in.
Oh really?
Yeah. that was in the IMDb trivia. Oh, that it's actually Jesus. You know, it's only in the shot for like a second, but that it's actually one of those little like you know, cheap knockoff mini MP3 players. It's not actually like a USB drive. Which I thought was like very, very of its era.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of beautiful that remains yeah. an artifact.
Yeah, I like the big headphone that Jack is wearing.
Yeah,
headphone and microphone.
It's so good.
Yeah,
yeah. That very like, contrasted with kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Vibe. And that contrasted with Michelle's very sleek Bluetooth headset.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The field gear is a little clunkier than.
Yeah,
the,
definitely.
Than the office yeah. stuff.
And Jack just like the screen just not working whatsoever, so he has to rely on what Michelle's saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, yeah. especially that, like the room being so dark that they can't get a good identification.
Yeah, I liked that.
Yeah,
yeah. I wish they would have gotten like a little fun with it, and you know, maybe shot it on like a cheap
sort of yeah.
like mini DV or something. but you know, you can't have everything.
Yeah, definitely.
It's still a really good, mm-hmm. really good sequence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nina goes wild, and maybe I don't really know where to loop this in, but I guess here is good because we have our like Three Stooges terrorists in the van with the bomb, Curly, Moe, and Larry.
This is such a goofy thing to introduce. It's like it made me think of like more than anything, like. It's this sort of thing where I wonder if this will be a recurring thing, if 24 is the kind of show that will alternate between like the sort of, you know, like hyper competent or at least like very, very scary, very serious terrorists, and also like the sort of stereotype of terrorists as being like these bumbling fools. Like I'm specifically thinking of Back to the Future.
Yeah. Yeah.
The terrorists there where the somehow the guy manages to like jam one like a Kalashnikov which can throw in the mud and will not yeah. get will not get clogged. Like he somehow managed to jam an AK-47.
Yeah.
Like and like all of that sort of that I feel like that I mean I could I have a somewhat limited frame of reference for that, but I feel like that was a fairly common sort of trope, is like the bumbling sort of terrorist, and like to see it make an appearance here, it makes me wonder if that will be something that happens elsewhere.
Well, you've got your classic three-man lineup, which is you've got the one squirrely guy who you know uh-huh. is going to break, who really isn't up to it because he just yeah. like looks at some kids and
playing basketball,
starts sweating, freaking out, right?
Yeah.
Then you've got like, you know, and that's probably like that's like your Curly, okay? Mm-hmm. And then you've got your Mo, who's always like kind of a bigger guy, kind of a heavy. And he's the main guy, you know, he's the guy that's clearly kind of in charge, mm-hmm. And he's going to dole out the punishment, you know, mm-hmm. he's a man on a mission. And then you kind of got your other guy, you got your Larry over there who kind of ping pongs back and forth, right?
Sure.
He'll kind of happily beat up on the other guy, but you know, is a little bit shocked at the violence that unfolds. And then, you know, he's not a go-getter. You know, he follows the orders, and now he's screwed because he's just like frantically looking around like, oh no, what do I do now?
Yeah.
This is not the plan. This uh-huh. is not like he can't think on his feet. You know, they didn't, Right. He's always going to play second fiddle on the missions. He's useful in that role, but if things go sideways, he's just like completely out of his depth.
Yeah, you know? I completely forgot that apparently these guys were actually in the first two episodes. Like they were loading the bomb on the truck from where Mason got radiation poisoned. Apparently, oh, yeah.
Totally apparently, forgot yeah. that. Wow. Yeah.
I completely did not realize that. Also, the pool guy that helps them with their car.
That reminded me of like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the John Candy character.
Right. And the actor is actually Greg Grunberg's brother.
That's so good. We got Bargain Grundgren down there. That's so good. That's like getting Joe Estevez. He's the Joe Estevez of that acting family.
Oh man, that's yeah. Like it's just like such a goofy touch. Like the it's just like the truck blowing its tire for no reason. Them not having like a way to lift up the car. Or something.
So classic.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's set up like a Three Stooges gag. That's why like it's like okay, this banal thing goes wrong. But then that like leads on to things really, really going wrong.
Yeah, you know? And especially the guy surviving like three gunshots to the chest.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like you know, like I was wondering why didn't they just push the guy out of the truck and then and, like it's revealed it's because he has to walk around so he can get in the prime position to get shot himself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just consummate gag work going on there. I don't have anything else to say about it.
Yeah, that, like it's just like such a like it's so basically good. A non sequitur. Like I don't know what like they just had to have it in there just to.
I mean, I guess
complicate
they had to,
things.
I guess yeah. they had to remind us that there is like a real bomb moving around somewhere that will, you know, that could go off at some point, and that there's like people involved in that process. I don't know. It kind of like it makes the bomb seem less scary than it is because it's like, look,
yeah, exactly.
If these are the guys that are in charge of the bomb, how bad could it possibly be? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it might matter. I'm speculating here, and you may know this because you look ahead, but I'm somewhat speculating that it might matter because Nina now holds the location where the bomb is supposed to be, right? Mm-hmm. Supposedly. But because that might change, like because the logistics of the bomb have there's supply chain issues. Now, like, I feel like the information she has is not going to be useful, and that's going to have some knock-on effects in the Jack level of the plot. That's my guess anyways, or it could just be that this guy just drives it where it's at and, you know, some bumbling cops come along and find these two dead guys, and that maybe that'll be consequential in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently the one of them was like, there was a deleted scene where one of them was confronted by an angry racist redneck from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m.
Oh, okay. Oh, and then that kind of makes sense.
So they would have had like at least one more
with
scene.
The pool guy.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
That might have worked a little bit because that just feels such like a goofy setup. Like, here are these guys, you know, who you think that this is why. Again, this is a perfect example of how this show is like a perfect distillation of, you know, American liberalism. It's like, okay, so you think that this, you know, kind of overweight sort of schlubby white guy is going to see these, you know, three sort of suspicious looking Middle Eastern men and immediately start doing some racist shit, and it's like, no, he's just a helpful nice man. Mm-hmm. And these guys actually are terrorists.
Yeah,
and it actually would have been good if he would have been suspicious and racist here.
Yeah, and specifically the guy who initially shoots the driver,
yes,
who's confronted by the redneck. Man, I should be keeping better track of this deleted scenes page, because they don't really list them on the episodes, but there's an entire
page. Okay.
Apparently, there was one scene in the season premiere where I'm just reading this now. Jack Bauer is approached by this young man, by this street kid in his car while stopped at a red light. He proceeds to run a squeegee over part of the windshield, then demands payment for cleaning the window. Jack ignores him at first until the young man leans into the car, puts his hands on the steering wheel, and demands payment. Uninterested in getting into a confrontation, Jack gives some money, some cash to the young man, who then leaves.
Like, what is that scene even doing?
Maybe he's like, he's supposed to be like a changed guy or something like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like him trying
just kind of like resigned. Yeah. Maybe we really goofed by not like tracking down the DVD box sets.
Yeah, I don't know if we need to watch them, but just like, just
maybe we'll have to
them.
Maybe we'll do some bonus content at some point.
Man, this like... is such a bleak page. It's just unnamed deleted characters.
This is the 24 graveyard, the shadow graveyard, you know.
Wow, there was a guy, there was an intern in season one who's deleted, but he still got a co-star credit.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's great. That's, you know, that's SAG right
yeah.
now. They're taking care of their people.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, well, this is the first post the beginning of the writer's strike also.
Yes.
That had a pretty big effect on, I think it was season 7 or something.
I think so, yes.
There was at least one season that was pretty pivotal.
Yeah, 24. Well, I think I was reading about it because, mm-hmm. of course, there was all kinds of Twitter discourse about the effects of the writer's strike on on television, which, of course, you know, all right-thinking people stand in solidarity with the mm-hmm. with the WGA, and mm-hmm. We hope they take the producers for all they're worth. But, you know, people were complaining about, well, you know, TV was so bad last time or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think I wasn't really paying attention to it, so I wouldn't be surprised if some of this was, like, you know, kind of that bad faith misinterpretation that we're always doing on Twitter. but it did lead to a sort of interesting, I did read kind of, I guess, this thread kind of looking at the actual, like, effects on some different TV shows. Mm-hmm. And 24, I think, was, like, maybe halfway through. But I don't think it had aired yet. So I think they shelved it and waited to just do the whole thing in one instead of like pausing the show in the middle. Mm-hmm. If I remember right, I could be misremembering that, but yeah, I mean, it was pretty disruptive, but I think it was less obvious on 24 because I think the season still ended up running continuously once the strike was over.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Because I don't remember. Was it in the summer last time too? Probably.
I actually don't. That would seem right. I don't. I think that maybe when there are these strikes or these longer negotiations, the term of the collective bargaining agreement shifts. But I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, it would make sense.
Yeah.
That it would. That's when the term of the agreements would end. Would be after like this. After the season is over, right? Mm-hmm. So you would negotiate in between. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a I took a brief look through the deleted scenes. I don't think there was anything especially notable. There is one that like where in when Kim and Megan are on the run together, where they see a police car approaching, so they hurry away. Kim notices a line of parents waiting for a school bus, so she approaches one father, and Megan points out how cute his baby Caitlin is. They note that Caitlin and Megan look similar and they could be sisters. And the police car drives by. Kim then bids the father a farewell, and they leave.
So strange.
It's
so
strange. Like I kind of like that in a, like a pure character sense, but it also a little bit of a, it kind of makes, like, I feel like even though 24 certainly has its fair share of like of weird one scene sort of or one episode sort of characters, I feel like this is one of the more this pool guy is one of the most like easily one of the most odd. Choices or odd inclusions in this way.
Yeah. I definitely think that it's a show that, like, I do think a real writing challenge of the show is trying to get in some beats like this.
Mm-hmm,
Like there was the waitress that Jack takes hostage.
Yeah,
in
I was
season
thinking
one,
about that.
Right, mm-hmm. Like that's kind of a similar thing. That's a little more consequential.
Yeah,
because I think it ends up stretched over like two episodes, but maybe not. Maybe it is two. I don't remember.
I think it's one episode, but like that is a great sort of just
character
moment. Also, like tinged by is she going to turn him in or not?
And I think that like it is hard to get those moments in when you are churning through so much like intrigue and sensationalist mm-hmm. stuff, it's hard to be like, well, yeah, we still want these moments. I do think this is a good transition. I do think that this is like a good thing that they do with Mason.
Oh yeah.
In these episodes too, is that phone call with his son, because of course Mason is a deadbeat dad. Like, come on. Like, we knew it, but confirming it is nice too.
Definitely.
You can definitely see why he doesn't get along with his son, who is just like, he's like working in a food truck. He's got like, he's got kind of like a surfer vibe going on a little bit.
He seems
like
he's having a good time.
Yeah. Like he's a cool dude. And Mason is this very sort of stuck up, you know, he's probably, probably didn't get very good grades or what, you know, and Mason just kind of a hard ass. But that is like a moment.
It's a drink stand, and they're like, the name of it is Juice and Joe. And the tagline, which you can see on the back of his shirt or something like that, is Juice and Joe on the go.
I need a Juice and Joe shirt. They're really leaving money on the table, not making kind of merch.
But yeah, it's such a, like, I love Mason just arresting his son so he can bring him in.
That's so, like, of course this is his solution. Like, it's amazing. But yeah, that first conversation of just like his son quite understandably being like, you think you can just like demand that I come see you, like, and it's like, you know, it's Mason's struggle, you know, to be vulnerable and just be like,
but he's also clearly too proud to actually say
Like, I get why he's, I think in the work setting, there's like a real reason why he's not doing that, which is he doesn't want to be taken off the job, you know, but that of course is like tied into, you know, his pride. And, and that's even more on display here, where he's just like, no, I'm your dad and you have to do what I say. And his son is like, no, you don't ever talk to me. Get out of my life.
Right. And it's also, I think, very interesting that he doesn't say like that he's going to die like probably in a day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just says I'm dying. Like, he like, that's just not information that he needs to share with with his son, because he doesn't plan on seeing him, so like it doesn't matter how long he lives.
I believe because he mentions like the money right in these accounts, and according to I don't know if it was Wiki24 or IMDb, but apparently this has been interpreted as an allusion to money he was sort of like embezzling in the first season, which is
The Wiki24 assistant. Like, it's very funny that Jack just didn't bother to I guess obviously Jack had already left like right after that day, but also like it's funny that he just didn't bother to mention that Mason just casually has a offshore account that has more than $100,000 in it.
Again though, another missed opportunity in the Jack Mason buddy show that will never be, because I love that dynamic. Like, this is the one, like, Jack kind of let, like, at any time Jack could have brought this back, but he kind of lets it slide. And, you know, like, the whole deal with Jack in the first season is that he is just like a stickler for the rules, you know, unless it concerns him, and then in which case he's above the rules. But yeah, I like appreciate that. It's like very subtle, but the gesture of just like Jack being like, you know what, fine, like I'm not gonna turn you in. Xander Berkeley just doing grade A work. In a stretch of episodes where basically everybody is doing grade A work, he still sticks out as just like killing it. Like when he freaks out on the guy.
Like, it's the sort of thing where like I wasn't entirely certain if it was like strictly in character, but like it works well enough, like with him just like shouting and raving as Tony's holding him back. Like, he manages to sell it as reasonably as anyone could, really.
Yeah. I think it's just like, I think he's really starting to fray at the edges as it becomes very clear that he is not going to survive much longer. Yeah. So I bought it in that sense of like a really desperate guy who's trying to do one last good thing.
Right.
I'm
wondering,
will it to happen?
Yeah. I'm wondering if he's like, just like, he's going even harder because he sort of like his, he wants to be like remembered as the guy who managed to stop the bomb and like as
oh,
his
absolutely.
Last act. Yeah. Like
yeah.
a legacy sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, he wants like redemption. You yeah. know? Mm-hmm. It's like he can't he wasn't given enough time to like fix all the problems he caused in his life, you know,
right,
all the people
right.
he's abandoned and let down. But mm-hmm. if he can save LA, like for him at least, that like
yeah.
makes up for it a little bit too, I think.
Right. Yeah, like that sort of makes me think about like the how people have certainly made a lot of the like and rightly so made a lot of like the vastly increasing stakes of each season of 24.
Yes.
Where like where Mason has like he'll only have gotten to the second part, but still like for
yeah.
him certainly at this point it's good enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not maybe not compared to what Jack is able to do in
yeah,
seasons.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
Like, but like it certainly fits in with his this like this going out on a high note sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like we'll have more to talk about with the Kate and wedding stuff. Like I love like how completely disbelieving she is that her father could possibly have anything to do with working for the government. And also like that it takes him this long to reveal it.
Yeah, the two things about that whole plot is that one, the like kidnapping thing at the end is just goofball.
Yeah. Yeah.
But fine. It's fine.
Yeah. We can finally she can get out of that house and actually do something.
Yes. Yeah. But and then she's also with this like new private investigator guy. So that's like a weird choice.
Yeah.
But then also just like the dad being supposedly like CIA is like very funny, but that's like, you know, there's obviously going to be some like interagency competition there, but also uh-huh. in like how clearly the show just lays out that it's like, he's just some guy who has a company and the CIA uses him as like this cutout essentially. And he just like yeah. confesses to that. He's just like, oh yeah, my company is just like a CIA front,
yeah.
which again is like, goes back to that thing about the show, because it's just like problem solving, accidentally uh-huh. doing things sometimes that are like, whoa, I can't believe that. They just were like, yeah, this is how the CIA works. They just pay business guys to do weird stuff and move money around and get information. And also like the way that's set up is so clumsy too, because it's like, you know, Tony's even like, what, at any, you could have said this at any time. It's like, what is the difference between you saying this like in your office at your house
yeah.
and saying it like after you've been taken into custody? It's so
right.
goofy.
And it clearly like the dad is, he thinks that this is going to automatically get him out of the holding cell and back
yes,
to his
yeah.
wedding.
Yeah.
And Tony's just so nonplussed about it. You could tell the dad is just absolutely furious that he's still like sitting there.
Yeah, some of those people still think that wedding's happening today, and I got news for them. It is not going down.
Yeah,
I get the feeling that that stuff is like not, I get the feeling it's going to develop in the next two episodes in a way that makes it at least gives us more to talk about, because it still
yeah.
feels like that those kind of plot lines are being like redistributed across the show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now that they've kind of broken up the party, so to speak.
So
that'll be kind of interesting to see. I don't relish another kidnapping plot, you know? But what are you gonna do? That's like, this show is about two things. It's about terrorism and it's about people getting kidnapped just randomly all the time. Yeah
it's a that's a very good point. We do get a very good like classic soap opera three-way shouting match between Marie, Reza, and Kate. That sort of like I do find it very funny that Kate is just there all by herself in that house.
Just kind of wandering around.
I kind of would have liked to seen just like a lot of wandering and like not immediately going into the random private investigator plot, but I mean, like
yeah.
it's sort of, it would have been kind of like I said, like just like to have that complete sort of just random life going on, sort of
yeah,
not being immediately connected to intrigue.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's definitely back into the classic 24 formula for that.
Yeah,
that power play that Jack does on the plane when he forces Nina to change in front of him.
Yes, very tension filled.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think we talked maybe we only talked a little bit about the reporter stuff, but that scene with when it's just Sherry and the reporter,
yes,
it's quite good, especially because he has like 80 different magazines and newspapers laid out in front of him.
Well, you know, they gave him reading material. That's not, yeah. You know, it's like, can you really say you've been illegally confined if there were, it's just a waiting room. There were magazines. You read them. We just put you in the president's very busy. You're just in the waiting room.
They should have just picked up that chess set and brought him in. Have him playing correspondent chess with him and Palmer. Like Palmer's just occasionally like looking up using like Deep Blue 5 to dominate the reporter.
Yeah, that's great.
And I love that scene with Tony and Michelle. They're finally back together.
Yeah,
and
I think that's. I know you've talked about how much you like that dynamic.
Yeah,
and it's been so long since I watched the season that I don't really remember how it develops. But that was the first time for me where I was like, "Oh yeah, this really clicks, mm-hmm. doesn't it?" Like, mm-hmm. like the actors are working well together. It mm-hmm. feels very organic in the show as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like the sort of like very simple staging of it, but like Michelle looking up at Tony and that sort of like watery eyes sort of thing is stuff I really love.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I'm excited to see, much as I love and will miss Mason, I do feel like Tony's been a little bit sidelined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Mason stuff. And I do like to see Tony firing on all cylinders.
So yeah, especially.
I feel like we'll get there.
Yeah, it's like sort of a, kind of a, like, in a way, like it's like a, him, like that sort of combination of him with Kate.
Yeah.
Like, sort of like, putting him like I could have seen like Kim and Kate working on like a sort of equal level in terms of like main cast sort of status, but like because it's all from Kate's perspective, so Tony's been having to play second fiddle in that storyline of all storylines for a while, so like it I don't know if it quite works like it's pulled off quite as well as or like he's definitely had less to do, but now that he's back at CTU, hopefully it'll be better.
Yeah. Well, I think that does it, and we'll be back for the next two episodes. So, hang in there.